The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Glenn Beck Program. Trump's meeting with the Russians was closed to the U.S. media, but not closed to the Russian media. How does that make us look, honestly, when our media is blocked from covering a meeting, but the Russians can cover it, and so all of the coverage is coming from the Russian side? James Comey has sent a farewell letter to the FBI that I think is worth perusing. The stories are coming out now about what really happened and why Donald Trump truly made the decision to fire James Comey and when that decision was made. And it's not going to go well for Donald Trump. It's just not going to go well. How do we navigate this? Or does President Trump possibly become the first president to be impeached and removed from office? I never believed. People are like, he's going to be impeached by summer. I never believed that. If there is anything to this Russian stuff, he's in big trouble. Let's begin there right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
President Trump has picked a bad time for a meltdown. People are now once again questioning and doubting his stability. And Washington Post has done an incredible story on what really happened. The New York Times is also reporting on this. This is everywhere. Even Matt Drudge has said he's got to clean out the entire West Wing because the leaks are bigger than anybody has seen, at least in modern history, of leaking at the White House, and shows that Donald Trump is very alone in his own West Wing. And you know, when Matt Drudge is saying this could bring down the presidency, these leaks could bring down the presidency, you've got some problems. Washington Post is reporting 30. In their story, they have 30 unnamed sources verifying exactly what happened. 30.
Yeah, and it's 30 officials at the White House, the Justice Department, the FBI, and on Capitol Hill, as well as Trump confidants and other senior Republicans.
30. Wow. I mean, you know, remember, Watergate was, can you get a second source? 30. President Trump is, did you see the cover of Time magazine yet? They just went and did a tour of the White House with Donald Trump. And they hired this avant-garde photographer who said, I wanted you to feel the White House as he feels the White House. So he took this tour, but he took all of the pictures with Donald Trump kind of way back. It was just him and Donald Trump walking through the White House. And he said, you know, everybody on the outside says that they hate him. He's in the inside and he's got people who are leaking like a sieve. He said, I wanted to present how lonely he must feel. And so these pictures are stunning because he created that. I mean, I know this is art and culture creating even more of the myth, but it's how Donald Trump must feel today. Because he can't know who to trust in his own White House now. With 30 leaks, and who do you trust?
It doesn't necessarily mean that he did anything wrong here. No. What's interesting about it is when you start firing people that others respect, you get enemies. You get batches of them. And 30 sources doesn't mean necessarily, I mean, they could all be lying. Let's just like take the best possible Trump scenario here. All of those 30 people are lying. The problem with that is you create, and I don't believe that, but you create a group of people who don't like you. This happened, it happens in sports all the time, as like a Jeffy instead of Glenn, to give the reference. But for example, the Philadelphia Eagles, my favorite team, by the way, had Chip Kelly, the head coach, for 3 years. And Chip Kelly went 10-6, 10-6, and 7-9. So he didn't make the playoffs his last year, two of the 3 years, but he had good records. He had above 500 record when they fired him. And the reason they fired him was not because they couldn't win any games. It was because over time, he had created so many enemies inside the organization. He was constantly being hit in the media. He was bad at dealing with that stuff. And one of the big issues that led to his dismissal was because the organization, inside the organization, they just didn't like him anymore.
So here's the thing. Donald Trump has made so many, let's say he's right on everything. Donald Trump has made so many enemies politically. As soon as his, quote, friends, which I don't think he has very many friends, as soon as his friends see that he's a wounded animal, he's in trouble because they will all scramble for the hills because they're all weasels. Mm-hmm. They're all weasels. That's and we know that about everybody in Washington. However, he doesn't help himself. This isn't just about firing Comey. He could have come out and said, and fired him long ago, saying, look, I don't trust him. He is under employment at my discretion. He works for the executive branch. He works for me. I can replace him at any time for any reason. I don't like him. I don't trust him. Now, this is yesterday on TV. We were talking about this and we're going over it. And I'm like, okay, so this doesn't make sense in a, you remember, it's the opposite of Barack Obama giving the order to kill Osama bin Laden. Remember that took him months, took him like, what, 6 months to make that decision? By the way, and an hour from now, we have the guy who pulled the trigger and killed Barack Obama. Osama bin Laden. We have him on here in about an hour, and he's fascinating. He's got some new things to talk about. But it took him forever to make that decision. That was the easiest decision in the world. Yesterday, we started talking about Donald Trump. Okay, so the deputy director the deputy attorney general comes out and has this letter. Then the attorney general comes out with a letter. And within hours, that started in the morning. Within hours, that afternoon, Comey was fired. There were three letters that were written. Deputy director, the assistant attorney general, the attorney general, and then Donald Trump's, all within 6 hours. You don't make a decision that big that fast. And 2 days ago, they were saying, well, it's because, I mean, look, even, what's his name, Rothstein or whatever, even he's saying, and he worked, okay. What you didn't know was Tuesday night, Wednesday, he was thinking about quitting. Because Donald Trump asked him to write that letter. I want you to make a case on why he needs to be out. And then Donald Trump went and said, it's because of him. I mean, look at what he's writing.
Right. And apparently he didn't like that. Again, that's a...
Would you?
No, not at all. That is one report. That's only one source that's saying that at this point. However...
we have multiple sources.
The Trump administration is now admitting that their desire to fire Comey predated him even being in the
Correct.
Administration.
Because some of these 30 sources talked about what even happened this weekend.
Yeah.
He did not like Comey for two reasons. Donald Trump didn't like Comey for two reasons. Multiple sources on this. One, he didn't like, when was it, Monday during testimony, that Comey said he felt squeamish.
He said nauseous. It was mildly nauseous.
I'm mildly nauseous to think about that what I did might have influenced the election.
But I would have done the same thing anyway.
Correct. So Donald Trump interpreted that. How else? What, you didn't like that I won? You didn't want to help me? No. The director of the FBI should not be doing anything to affect an election. If I thought I did anything to affect an election and I'm a government official in that role, I'd be squeamish too.
Right. It had nothing to do. He was not bashing Donald Trump with that comment.
Donald Trump took it as a personal slam.
Yes.
There's a second reason that Donald Trump didn't like Comey.
Yes, he in a earlier statement, he was talking about
I threw it to you because I couldn't remember it either. Isn't that funny?
I should have known.
Yeah.
We talked about him right before we went on the air.
Yeah, we were just discussing this.
We'll come back to it.
Okay, so Donald Trump took them as... Oh, I remember what it was. He wouldn't go and look into the leaks.
He didn't defend him on the wiretapping. That's what he said. Right. He said in a previous testimony, right. I have no evidence to support those tweets.
Correct.
When it came to Obama wiretapping him.
Now, the one thing that I have heard from the White House that I agree with is that Donald Trump didn't like the fact that he didn't pursue the tweets or the leaks, that he wasn't looking into who leaked the information. I think that's Susan Rice. And I think that's really, really important. We have to know about Russians and we have to know and hold them responsible on who leaked information. So he didn't like that they weren't pursuing the leaks as much as he wanted. He didn't like the fact that he wouldn't back him up on wiretapping. And he didn't like that he said he was mildly nauseous from the idea that he affected the election. That last one, apparently, was the last straw. And that's when Donald Trump apparently had been raging over the weekend about it. And then that happened. And that's when he called everybody in. But I thought Jeff Sessions had recused himself for any conversations or anything having to do with Comey and the wiretapping and the Russian thing.
The Russian thing specifically.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So how was he called into this to fire the guy who is now, we find out, asking for more money and resources to pursue the Russian involvement and the Trump connections to Russia? He shouldn't have been called and he shouldn't have been in that meeting. Instead, he's in that meeting when Trump says, I want you guys to come up with some things to fire him. And they do. The next day, he fires them.
Yeah,
good.
It's just it's bad. Look, it's bad. And as far as the media is beating up on them and they're saying, well, you said the exact opposite thing just a few months ago. But let's not let it slide here that the media and the left is just as guilty on this. These are people who are now criticizing the Trump administration, and I think rightfully so, for changing their opinion on this guy in a matter of weeks.
But
they were running a hashtag fire Comey campaign up until the moment it happened.
Yeah.
And now they're completely shocked. They can't believe this would ever occur. This is the craziest thing any president has ever done.
Yeah.
They all wanted it
for a different reason.
Right.
They just wanted it for a different
reason. The same reason he gave.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the interesting parts of this, and I can't believe
this. Well, but you know that wasn't true about Donald Trump. That's the problem.
Right. They know it's not real.
If Donald Trump would have fired him for real reasons, if he would have just said, because the problem with Donald Trump is he's a vindictive, I'm sorry to say this, but it's obviously true. He is a guy with very low self-esteem, and he covers it with his bluster. And anyone who stands against him, he wants to destroy. So he feels like this guy doesn't like him, isn't on his side, says bad things about him. I want him out. But it's beyond that. It's not call him into the office and let's do an exit like it should be, which would have been fine. It was fire him while he's giving a speech and humiliate him. That's where Donald Trump crosses the line every single time. He must humiliate anyone who is against him.
Yeah, there is some reporting that they weren't aware he was doing that, which is then that's just incompetence. How do you not know? I mean, how do you let the press get a hold of it if you don't have this letter in his hand? I mean, you send Jared Kushner himself or something to this to hand deliver this, and until it's in Comey's hand, no one else knows, right?
Yes.
I mean, you hand deliver it
and you say, the president wants to see you upon your return. That's how it happens.
Yeah. But the other part about this is apparently, and this is, again, multiple reports from inside the White House saying that they were not, they were very surprised by this reaction. They didn't see it coming. They thought they would fire Comey and the left would cheer. It would be the right they'd have a problem with. It would be because the left would just cheer.
Being honest, you can't expect people to cheer if you're not being honest. When he said, the problem is, he said, the reason why he did it is because of, you know, all the things that Hillary Clinton people were saying, fire him on. Well, you're on record saying that stuff was great. And your defense is, well, I talk out of both sides of my mouth. There's the election me and the presidential me. That's not good. That's not good. And so what are you going to do? There's no way you can defend that.
To be clear, though, if he did tell the truth and all of that stuff happened, they still would be attacking him for this.
Hold on just a second. That's because his truth is not rooted in any principle.
Is it? I mean, it's also theirs. I mean, the left and the media are going to attack this guy no matter what.
Oh, I agree.
You can understand and believe that and also be critical of Donald Trump.
But hang on just a second. But you're putting us, because that's where we are, by the way. I'm critical of the press. I'm critical of the left. But I'm tired of preaching to the guys that, you know, hate my guts and aren't going to listen. I'm trying to make a whole new group of people to hate my guts. I'm trying to preach to the people who claim to have our same principles. So we know who the press is. We know who the left is. Now the only question that remains is, who are we? Who are we? And we should be people on principles. And there are many principles, I think, to fire Comey. The biggest one is, look, James, I have to let you go because there are legitimate questions now in the FBI. You're becoming too big of a celebrity, hot potato. That's not good. Now, you've done a great job. I know you've been in impossible positions. I know you and I disagree on some things. On other things, we totally agree. I need somebody who is not the face of law enforcement. Law enforcement should never become celebrity, mm-hmm. ever. It's dangerous. That's a real principle that the president could come out and defend himself on and say, is there no one in the White House that could even come up with that, let alone actually believe it? Let me give you another. When I say you can't defend, he's leaving you defenseless. Let me tell you what happened with The Economist. And this one, holy cow, this one will make your blood run cold. I don't even know how to explain this one.
The Glenn Beck Program.
The fusion of entertainment and enlightenment.
We are one. The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
888-727-BECK.
Hello, America. So glad that you are... So glad that you're with us today. Having a frank conversation, would love to have you chime in at 888-727-BECK. We all know, we're trying to have a higher conversation here. We all know the responsibility of the press that they shirked long ago. We know they have a vendetta for Donald Trump. We know that. We know the Democrats, we know what they're going to say. We know that they want to have it both ways. They were literally running a hashtag Fire Comey campaign. And now they're crazy that he would have the guts to fire Comey. So we all know that. The question is, who are we? And what do we believe? Separate and apart from what we believe about those guys. Let's just look at our section. And I want to show you an example of something that I think is quite disturbing from The Economist when we come back.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
All right. Tomorrow, I think, still trying to lock down the time, but I think Bill O'Reilly is going to be on with us tomorrow on the broadcast, which, wow, do I want to hear his take on all of this. So that will hopefully later on in the show today, we'll have a time for Bill O'Reilly. So you don't want to miss that tomorrow. I don't think he's been heard in public at all since he left.
His podcast.
Yeah, on his podcast, yep. That's right.
But yeah, he is not.
BillOReilly.com. Mm-hmm. Okay, so talking about Donald Trump and this quest now to have him impeached or lame duck, at least lame duck. This is not helpful to have a lame duck president. And a president who is hated, a president that can't get anything done. We have to find a way to heal this. The way to heal things usually is to return to principles. The problem is, I don't know if anyone has any principles. We know that the left, and I'm talking about the people, the power, not our neighbors, but the uber left has principles and they don't violate them. The uber right, I think, has principles and they don't violate them. We know we don't want those principles because those principles lead to our destruction. Then you get into the Democrats and Republicans. Their principles are only to win. And that leads us to places like hashtag Fire Comey, led by the people who are behind, you know, Hillary Clinton. And they're marching for him to be fired. He's the villain for the last 2 weeks. He's the villain. The Republicans fire him, or Donald Trump fires him, and now all of a sudden, that's the craziest thing they've ever heard. And no one in the press, because we know the press's principles, no one in the press really cares. This Russian probe. Here's what we should be talking about today. Washington should be having hearings on who leaked the names of that Russian probe. We think that it was Susan Rice. They've asked her. She said no. Okay. All right. Well, she's got so much credibility. Okay. Whoever it is should be found and pay a price. That is a huge violation of national security. It's a violation of the Constitution as well, I believe. Two, we should be finding out who, if anyone, had anything to do with the Russians during the campaign. If it's Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or anyone below them, we need to know it. And we need to have it exposed, and those people need to pay a price. Those two things are the real issues. Everything else is a circus to make you forget. Forget about Susan Rice. Forget about Susan Rice. Look at him. 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 Look at what he's doing. Call me. Call me. Call me. Call me. Call me. Same thing on the right. Forget about the wiretaps. Forget about Russian interests. Forget about that. Call me. Call me. Call me. Call me. Call me. It's a game. So those of us who still care about the country and not playing the game, because the game is only going to get ratcheted up further and further and further, and the same result until it just destroys itself. They are both on the path of mutually assured destruction. And so I don't think they care, because there's enough on the left and the right that have now infiltrated both parties that want that. I don't want that. I don't want our country to collapse. I don't want to go at war with my neighbor. There's a lot of people that are on the left that I like. A lot that I don't. A lot that I think are dangerous. But there are some on the right that I also think are dangerous. Return to principles. Well, you can't. Here's why. This is from The Economist. There's a story in The Economist now about what is the economic plan of the president. And I just want to quote this. This is all in verbatim. Okay. So this is question, answer, question, answer. This is not somebody writing this. This is verbatim. But beyond that, it's okay if the tax plan increases the deficit. Trump, it's okay because it won't increase it for long. You may have 2 years where you understand the expression prime the pump. Yes, we have to prime the pump. Well, that's very Keynesian. We're the highest tax nation in the world. Have you ever heard that expression before for this particular type of event? priming the pump?
Yeah. Have you heard it?
Yes.
Have you heard the expression used before? Because I hadn't heard it. I mean, I came up with it a couple of days ago and I thought it was good. It's what you have to do. Priming the pump is an expression that you'd never heard before. You'd never heard prime the pump, and you claim to come up with it a couple of days ago? Priming, what the hell do you think quantitative easing is? What do you even think helicopter money is? What do you think tax cuts are? You're priming the pump. Priming the pump is Keynesian. It has been out for Keynesian. It's come out, how do you say it?
Keynesian.
Mm-hmm. It's been out since the Depression, and before that it was used for actual pumps.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a phrase that's about actual pumps from the mid-1800s.
So he's talking to a guy from The Economist that can talk deeply, and our president thinks he came up with the term, the economic term, priming the pump. Now, here's why this is a problem. It shows you haven't thought about this at all. If you have been in business, how do you not know priming the pump? How do you not know? Do we have that clip from Vice President Biden? You play that, Sarah? Do you have it?
Now, people say, when I say that, people look at me and say, what are you talking about, Joe? You're telling me we got to go spend money to keep from going bankrupt? The answer is yes, I'm telling you.
That's called priming the pump.
Yeah, it's usually used by the left. I mean,
correct. So he's never thought of stimulus. So when he was talking about a $1 trillion stimulus package, he didn't really understand the concept of priming the pump.
Which is, I believe, an incorrect concept. However, if you're going to spend $1 trillion, you should probably know it.
So he didn't think of that. It didn't connect to him that, yes, we're going to spend $1 trillion, but that will get the economy starting to roll. Now, how is that even possible? More disturbing is, I think, how this happened. He wasn't just in bed going, you know what? It's like the old pump. And remember, you had to prime it a couple of times, push it a couple of times to get it going, and then it would. He wasn't laying in bed thinking about that. I mean, Viagra, I would imagine, is what he thinks of as priming the pump. But he wasn't sitting thinking about an old water pump and priming the pump and then tying that to economic theory. Here's probably what happened. He's sitting in a meeting and they're talking about the economy and what they're going to do. And somebody says, that's priming the pump. And he probably thought, you know what? What you just said, you're all wrong about. Because you're probably talking about the water or Viagra or something. But if we use money instead of water, priming the pump, and probably everybody in the room was too afraid or whatever to say, that's what this is, priming the pump. That's what we were talking about. You don't think you just came up with that. They didn't say anything. So he goes off thinking, I am a freaking genius. I heard some guy talking about priming the pump. And I thought to myself, wait, we're in an economic meeting. Let's tie that principle to money. You got to get that water flowing. Once you get that water up to the top, then one little push and it all starts to... I'm a genius. That is...
It's a suboptimal, I would say.
Can you give him the benefit of the doubt? As the economist, verbatim.
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right on how that's happened. Merriam-Webster today has been tweeting about how the term was first tied to economic principles in 1933. I think honestly, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Glenn, because it's scary that he. You know, it's a ridiculous moment, right? But I mean, it's sort of Trumpian. And maybe you're like, well, you know, he has these moments and he takes credit for everything. And Okay, he invented everything. He's always had the highest ratings. Like, maybe you could brush it off from that perspective where he's just kind of bragging about what he does. But in the, what he's talking about is a liberal economic policy.
Yes.
He doesn't reject Keynesianism. He sticks with it. He does. In fact, he doesn't even, well, he doesn't comment on it at all. Whether he knows what it is or not, I don't know. But the concept of priming the pump is very clearly a left-wing principle. It's Paul Krugman central, right? It's all about, like, wow, you just, remember what Paul Krugman said?
It's what we've been doing.
Yeah. Remember when Paul Krugman was like, well, if we just had aliens coming down, if we thought aliens were going to attack, even if it wasn't a real attack, we would this economy would go crazy because we'd start spending and it would get all the spending going. That is a left-wing principle. And the fact that not only is that not offensive to him, he doesn't stop the interview and go, whoa, 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 that's not what I'm talking about at all. I'm talking about Keynesianism here. That's not what this is. He doesn't stop him because he doesn't either know or he does believe it.
I know.
And the second one's worse.
No. I don't think it's either of those. We have to prime the pump. It's very Keynesian. We're the highest tax nation in the world. Have you heard that expression before, this particular time of event, priming the pump? Yeah, have you heard of it? Yes, I heard the expression used before. I've never heard the expression used before. I hadn't heard it. I mean, I just came up with it a couple of days ago. I don't even think he's listening to the guy.
No.
His answers don't matter. The answers of yes, it's very Keynesian, priming the pump, it doesn't matter. He's just monologuing, and the answer could be anything.
Yeah.
He's so convinced. And the reason why I bring this up is, was anybody in the Oval Office saying, Mr. President, do you know what you're going to do by bringing, you're going to bring hell down on all of us? There are obviously 30 people that are talking to the Washington Post that don't feel like they're being listened to at all by this guy. And they're saying these things. I mean, his friends are saying these things. Is it because they feel like he's not listening and this could be trouble? I mean, there is a problem when you have 30 people in and around the West Wing that are leaking on something that could be the end of a presidency. That's not good.
No.
And I think it's because, is there anyone that is around him that is saying, Mr. President, stop.
It's funny, the only two I've seen that have been reported as to opposing the Comey firing, not because they loved Comey, but because they thought it would be this disaster of a PR issue. The only two that I've seen, Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently they were like, this isn't a good idea. It's not going to look good. Everyone else was like, well, it might not look good, but it's worth doing. At least that's the reporting. We'll see how that flushes out.
Glenn Beck program.
888-727 back.
Mercury. The Glenn Beck program.
So Lester Holt has probably the most important interview, at least of his lifetime so far, and could be the most important interview of Donald Trump's lifetime today. The White House has not canceled this. It was scheduled before today.
You don't cancel on Lester Holt.
Yeah,
what are you talking about?
I would, but he's going to be doing it at, I think, noon at the White House, and then they were planning on running it tonight for the nightly news.
And
but they're now talking about possibly just dumping it all online later this afternoon. I don't know, but let's see what Lester Holt gets from the president, because that obviously is really what this interview is going to be about.
And I think if it's really good for the president or really bad for the president, the blame can go to Jeffy, who is Lester Holt's biggest fan.
Yeah.
There is a creepy fanboy situation going on with Jeffy and Lester Holt. It's been going on for a long time, as long as we've known him, Glenn, since 2000 when he was on MSNBC. For some reason, Jeffy's always loved Lester Holt. The biggest moment in his career today.
Number one newscast in America right now.
I know, Jeffy. You remind us that almost every day. And strangely, no one's talking about Lester Holt, and you'll be like, do you see the ratings? Lester Holt's still number one. You're like, okay.
Why do you?
And where does it get him? Sit down with the President of the United States.
Yeah, should be
today.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Should be interesting tonight. A chance for the President to turn this around.
Or
make it much worse. Make it much, much, much worse. The guy who pulled the trigger on Osama bin Laden joins us. He has a lot to share. when we come back.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America, and welcome to the program. Glad you're here. We've got a lot to talk about. We've spent the last hour talking about James Comey and Donald Trump. This is turning into a very big nightmare. Apparently, this decision was not made because of the emails from the Justice Department. Those emails, Donald Trump asked them to write. This has been a decision that had been a long time coming, and it looks like for personal reasons, the president has a severe problem with leakage in the West Wing. The Washington Post has 30 sources on the story that are not saying good things. This is really not good. The reason why I bring up the long time coming and it wasn't a snap decision, I think the easiest decision to make in my lifetime that I've seen a president struggle over was President Obama struggling over the decision to kill Osama bin Laden. Did it take him 6 months or something like that? And finally they're like, Mr. President, yes or no? The guy who was there and fired the shot, the operator, Robert O'Neill, is here. Firing the shots that killed Osama bin Laden and his years as a SEAL Team warrior, he has been involved in some of the biggest stories of the last 10 or 15 years. And a lot of people don't know all the things that he has done. The guy who has helped shape the world we live in today, Robert O'Neill, joins us right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Robert O'Neill, how are you, sir?
I'm well. Thanks for having me here, Glenn.
Good to have you. The Operator is the book, Firing the Shots That Killed Osama bin Laden. Let's just talk a little bit about the country as you see it to get today, and we don't need to get into politics. I just want to get your sense of, as a guy who has seen countries, and I know special forces think about and train for countries coming apart at the seams. Are we a country getting more healthy or less healthy?
I think we're getting healthier now as far as foreign policy. I worked under Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And what I did see over the past few years is the weakening of American leadership overseas. And that's not just that affects the entire country, because if our allies see that we're not strong, they're going to back down too. And you have instances like with China building the islands, you have the Crimea thing with Russia, you've got the North Koreans. Everyone's kind of moving ahead because there wasn't a threat of deterrence. I'm not saying we need to go to war, but we definitely need the deterrent, be able to say we will do this if you keep doing this. We'd lost it for a while.
Yeah, I think the most impressive thing this president has done foreign policy-wise is Syria. I think that woke the world up and said, oh, wait, this guy means it. He's not going to just sit around. And we've restored a little bit of, I mean, I think the president of the United States always needs to be a best friend to everybody, unless you are on the wrong side.
Well, yeah, and I think he's doing it the right way, too. I mean, he's going to do something up front and then possibly negotiate in the back. Like the strikes in Syria weren't because we're going to invade you now. It's like, look, we got your attention. Now maybe we're going to do something about it.
What should we do in North Korea?
North Korea, I think, needs to be something done from within, more of an agency thing. As a special operator, I had trouble in Afghanistan, blending in Afghanistan.
No.
Yeah.
If we
invaded Scotland, I might have been okay.
Right.
But in North Korea, and just with the logistics needed to get in, you're going to have a difficult time. So we're going to need something with an infiltration, hopefully a military coup. Because as the world gets smaller with the social media and the internet, the North Korean people are starting to realize, wait a minute, we've been lied to for generations with Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and then this guy, Kim Jong-un, believing they're gods and having the people believe they're gods. That's what they're doing right now.
So how bizarre is that going to be for those people?
Well, they don't know any better. You only know what you're taught.
I know.
I mean, I've been to places in Afghanistan where I might as well have been in the 10th century in some of these valleys. They don't. Not only do they not know how old they are, they don't know what time is. And that's in the valleys. In North Korea, I don't even imagine. I mean, just the starvation, the slave labor, all this stuff, it's normal to them because they're taught propaganda.
What's the most concerning, geopolitically concerning thing to you right now?
It's got to be the North Korea with the nukes. If they get intercontinental ballistic missiles, that's a problem.
If we go to war with them, if it comes down to we have to go in and try to take them out, what does Seoul look like day two?
I think Seoul's going to get hit, but hopefully with some of the new air defenses we have might work. But it's the whole thing. Well, what if they shoot a missile at you? We'll shoot it down. Okay, what if they shoot 10,000 missiles at you? Something's going to get through. That's a tough one, too. And again, hopefully it doesn't come to a war in Korea. We've seen what happens before. I mean, thankfully, our military is designed to fight big armies, and they'll do it really, really well. But now something needs to be with the sanctions imposed by China because they're their biggest trade partner. But it needs to go further because China won't enforce them. If we put sanctions on North Korea and someone's trading with them, then you need to put sanctions on those people that are not enforcing the sanctions. So hopefully it doesn't come to a war, but Kim Jong-un's not.
Russia said summer before last that we're already in World War III. He said this to a group of European reporters. And he said, you guys have to convince your leadership. I've been begging to stay out of war. We're already in World War III, and it's happening digitally.
Putin is saying that. Yeah, he's still mad about the Cold War because he's KGB, and he's been out of it the whole time. He wants that back, so he kind of wants to be at war because there hasn't been a reason for him not to.
But we are in a cyber war.
Cyber war, no doubt, and we're having everything stolen from us.
How concerned are you that is a weapon of mass destruction in the wrong hands. Mm-hmm. How concerned are you that we're not really, the world is not really paying attention to any of the rules on cyber warfare?
They're not paying any attention, but I'm just hopeful eventually that when we need to take the gloves off, we have people smart enough to do it. We've proven it before with technology, but now we kind of back off because we want this big global society and make sure everyone's equal. When we get into electronic warfare and eventually like magnetic warfare, whatever's out there, this hypersonic aircraft, I don't know what's going to happen. I've been to war a bunch of times. I hope it doesn't come to it. It's not pretty. It's very fast and permanent.
Yesterday, I had a guy on who he wrote the book Homo Deus, and it is about how man is becoming God and going to merge with machines and everything else. And he said, we're seeing this already. The military is leading the way to where it doesn't take necessarily a massive army. You can do it.
You
can do it through the air. You can do it through drones. You can do it through robots, everything else. And he said, 20 years from now, army will not be the same. You don't need all those bodies.
No, you probably won't. Even I was reading an article on the way over here today that said the biggest problem with unmanned cars, driverless cars, is human drivers.
Right.
If there were no human drivers, it would be fine. There wouldn't
Correct.
Be a problem.
Right. The problem with humanity is humans.
Right. Yeah, it is.
So, right.
That's a good point.
Right.
Well, I've been to four-way stop signs here in Dallas, too, and I can see what they're saying.
Oh, yeah. No,
that could be an evolution. Yeah. It takes a while.
No, I know. So what does that do to the mentality when there is no life to a country like ours? We can just pay for everything and just keep going, and there's no life being expended. Does that bother you at all?
That's a lot to grasp. I think it does bother me once you lose the human element. And we're seeing it now with everyone's hands or their faces in their phones. Like humanity's kind of going, I don't know. I haven't really thought about it that deeply. But if we got wars with machines, eventually they're going to turn on us. Yeah. We'll have a whole Terminator type thing going on. Spooky.
Well, you've seen it in action with your military training has gotten far superior with help from drones.
Well, yeah,
computers,
I mean, drones,
everything.
Lasers, night vision, seeing that. Part of the reason
works.
We were so successful in combat wasn't necessarily that we wanted it more, because we're fighting people that know that if they die at our hands, they go to heaven. There's no doubt about it. We just happen to have the lights off, night vision, and lasers.
Right.
And we're quieter. And
the lasers, that technology is, you can paint people.
Nobody sees it.
And
not even that. You can light up an entire room with a floodlight that has a dot in the middle. I've come around corners lit up and have bad guys trying to ambush you, and you're like, are you kidding me right now? It's like playing paintball with my sister. she's not great at paintball. I'm just saying I was a SEAL for a while. Right.
that's not a game you want to enter into.
No. I don't think I'm playing paintball as a guy with SEALs.
We've had it before, though. Speaking of with kids, some of this technology, especially the games they play, I've had kids come up to me and start talking about guns, and because of the games they play, they know more about the guns that I use in combat, to the point they're asking me about how was the trigger shave, and I'm like, I don't know, kid. It makes this sound when you shoot someone, would you leave me alone? Maybe they're learning something. That's pretty funny.
Do you think the next generation will be better at killing? I mean, I'm sure you've read On Killing.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
Probably, I think because of a lot of the internet stuff, they're not as sensitive to it. I mean, even with the horrible videos ISIS puts out, I remember the first beheading video, even before Zarqawi did it, and I remember seeing it thinking that's the most horrific thing I've ever seen. Now there's so much of it, it's like, oh, another beheading video. Oh, another suicide bomber. Like, think about that, suicide bomber. They're getting desensitized. And I think a lot of it's the internet. And so, they might not be as good at it when it's up close, but it seems like it doesn't mean as much.
My charity, Mercury One, moved 6,000 people out of Syria and Iraq, Christians and Yazidis. We moved them 6,000. And we've started a program over there to where we are going back in and using operators on the ground, not Americans, but people like you, to go in and rescue these moms and children that have been taken. And I just got a report last week that said the things they were doing to these moms and children, it's a new generation now. It's just like you said, it was one of the most horrific things I've ever seen. Now, it's the next generation. And I was told it's beyond your imagination on how evil.
It's evil. And it's so bad that people won't want to hear it. They don't want to know about it. They pretend it's not there. It's worth going in, just getting back on ISIS, it's worth going in and wiping them out because of what our kids, our grandkids will have to fight. I always bring up, if you haven't seen the videos of they call it the Cubs of the Caliphate. They're these five-year-old kids that are executing people in horrific ways. If we don't stop that, what do you think those kids are going to be like in 13 years? Will they be normal? They're executioners at five. And we'll just kick the can down the road. I hate that analogy, but okay, grandkids, have fun fighting the jihad. You know, so it's a real thing.
You went, you were part of the rescue attempt to get Marcus Luttrell.
Yes, I was part of the coalition. A lot of us in different places, but we run the airfield when the rescue helicopters went to get him and were shot down. And I actually saw them come back, the survivors of the second, a Turbine 3-4, I believe it was, that survived. And then they had us walk in. So we spent about 2.5 days awake walking, trying to. We knew Luttrell was missing. We thought Axelson was missing, and we didn't know if there were survivors. So we were walking. It's like 120 degrees walking through the mountains of Konar province. And that was my first deployment with that elite SEAL team.
So when you go in there, tell me the difference between trying to save that SEAL team and what you think it might have been like to save, what was his name that deserted?
Bo Bergdahl.
Yeah.
I attempted to rescue him too. I was on the base when he walked off too.
So tell me the difference between those two.
Well, the difference was Marcus and his crew were in there on a noble mission trying to capture Ahmad Shah. A Taliban leader in the neighborhood. They got in a fight. They could handle themselves. They were in there because they wanted to be there. It was noble. And then the rescue attempt was to get in the fight. Really good guys getting in the fight. They got shot down with whatever they say shot them down. And then it's something that we want to do with Bergdahl. We knew he walked off the day he walked off. The way that we used to work, we'd wake up when the sun was going down, grab your coffee, go listen to the brief, and then you work overnight and then go to bed. During the day. When we got up that one day, they said, hey, we had this private walk off base and he got rolled up by the Taliban and we had to stop the entire war effort and stop trying to hit high value individuals and go after this guy, trying to just get intelligence on the fly, always moving. We were so close to the point where I actually had the ransom in my hands that the Taliban paid a family to get rid of Bergdahl to buy him. So, but the difference there was we knew that we're going after this loon that just misguided deserter. And then Luttrell, who's a hero.
Yeah, you knew he was a deserter. The second it happened.
Oh, yeah. I mentioned it in my book. There's stuff that was said that we were intercepting traffic about how the Taliban really wanted him because they just wanted to abuse him. And that we found this guy on the side of the road. He walked off. We knew he walked off. And then we spent days, I think 19 attempts my team had. We lost one of our dogs on it. He got shot and killed in a gunfight. But I know some soldiers were killed in other attempts to rescue Burgo.
And, so how do you deal with that?
With
how do you deal with, you know, how do you deal not, I would be frank with you, not beating a snot out of Bergdahl?
Well, I mean, we didn't get him. If we did, we would have wanted to, but it'd be important to get him back. Well, you can't.
Yeah, no.
I mean, he's an American. He's an idiot.
Yeah.
That's, you know, being an idiot's not a crime, but deserting is. So we'd want to bring him back and have him properly punished.
They're not really treated like he's a criminal.
No, he got his punishment with the Taliban. He got his punishment in their custody. Yeah, but when they came back, they made it political. They wanted to, you know, he's a hero. He's a distinguished service.
How did that make you feel?
It was terrible. The name Bergdahl, when we knew who he was, we knew what he was, a misguided deserter. But when they even tried to change it over the course of the years to, well, he didn't desert. He fell back on a patrol and they grabbed him, which is not the case at all. He mailed his stuff home. He walked off. No question. But they spun it politically. Like you can imagine some politicians will do.
Back in just a second. The name of the book is The Operator, Robert O'Neill, firing the shots that killed Osama bin Laden and my years as a SEAL team warrior. Back with him in just a second.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
Tomorrow on this program at this time, this hour, the top of the hour, at 5 minutes after the hour, tomorrow, we will be joined by Bill O'Reilly in his first interview since leaving Fox. We have a lot to talk to him about. That is tomorrow, Bill O'Reilly in his first interview leaving Fox. The operator is with us today. He is Robert O'Neill, firing the shots that killed Osama bin Laden. We were just talking about Bo Bergdahl, and you said that you had the ransom in your hands. Was that?
We were near the base. He was on a base that we were on, and he walked off of one of the nearby satellite bases, the small operating post. And when they told us he was gone, we just started launching from there, our strike team from our SEAL team. And we just started going after, gathering intel, and based on what we found on certain targets, we'd go after the next and the next for a matter of days. Mm-hmm. And we got to a point where we got into a house, big pile of cash, obviously some shady characters in there, and the whole, well, no, my son works construction in Dubai, so he sent this, you know, these millions and millions of rupees or whatever they were up there. So we had that. We're convinced that was it. We knew we were close, and then they eventually got him across the border to Pakistan.
So did that ransom was paid by?
The Taliban to the locals to take
him. Isn't that illegal?
I think a lot of it's illegal.
You saw the payment actually.
Well, incredible. We secured an area, separated, you know, the people like we do, and then we went through the stuff, and then there's a pile of cash in part of the trail where Bergdahl was going and had been. And I mean, it's pretty obvious what the money's doing there. They don't need that money there.
You know, it could have been Bitcoin investment,
Which is paying off paying off really well. Okay, back to talk a little bit about more in his book on killing Osama bin Laden, what that was like, how it was, what it felt like to be told, hey, by the way, you know, you guys are on your own, something happens, and a little bit about what he's doing now to continue to pay in to America. The Operator is the name of the book, Robert O'Neill. Back in a minute.
The Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. Glenn Beck Program.
Robert O'Neill was raised in Montana, joined the Navy at 19 in 1996, deployed as a Navy SEAL more than a dozen times, 400 combat missions, 4 different theaters of war. He was decorated more than 52 times. He's received 2 Silver Stars, 4 Bronze Stars with Valor. Holy cow. Joint Service Commendation Medal with Valor, 3 Presidential Unit Citations, and a Navy Marine Corps Commendation Medal with Valor. Kind of a big deal. Lone Survivor, he was part of that mission to save Marcus Luttrell. Captain Phillips and the Somali Pirates, which we're not going to get into today, but it's in his new book called The Operator. I'd love to hear about that. That is one of the most remarkable shooting I've ever seen.
Just getting there from a kiss on my daughter's forehead in her preschool for an Easter tea party to the Indian Ocean in less than 16 hours, because they let us know then, and then they called us, and then we're out, and then we're over there, and then we rescued them on Easter.
And then probably the, if somebody would have actually gone in and killed Adolf Hitler, those guys would have been known as, you know, known forever. That story would have been told. The killing of Osama bin Laden is probably that big, and our president had a hard time deciding whether to do it or not. When you guys went in, it's my understanding, he said, don't call the State Department. You're on your own. If things go wrong, you're on your own. Is that true?
I'm not sure how it went down with that. I know there were, we had talks amongst the group, what would happen if we ran out of fuel and had to negotiate our ways out. Who were they going to send over to Islamabad to talk with Zardari? Who's going to do what?
Right.
There's a lot of stuff that we compartmentalize as far as we know this and we know that. We don't need to get involved with the politics. But
so, but you went over there fully expecting to die.
I knew it was a one-way mission, and most of the guys there did too. But we accepted it because of we had the conversation. You know, we're doing this for the single mom who dropped her kids off at school on a Tuesday morning and then 45 minutes later jumped to her death out of the windows on the world because that was a better alternative than 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit inside, you know, holding her skirt down as her last gesture of human decency so no one could see her underwear as she killed herself. You know, she wasn't supposed to do that. The people on Flight 93 that took over the cockpit to crash it in Pennsylvania to save people in Washington, you know, they didn't need to fight the people in the Pentagon. We went for them because that wasn't their fight. The Port Authority, the police department, NYPD, FDNY, you know, that day that we were asked to take out the guy that funded that laughed about it, that, you know, that thought it was part of his time on Earth. We went for that. So we accepted the one-way mission.
Because this is your life at stake here.
Yes.
Right? Is it offensive when you hear, say, Joe Biden say this is the most difficult decision in 500 years? I mean, this is if you had only a 1% chance of success and you knew there's a 99% chance that you were going to die, would you still have wanted to go on that mission?
We didn't call dying. Dying didn't mean we didn't succeed. We knew that if I even moved myself from the perimeter to the rooftop team that was going to land there, and we called ourselves the Martyrs Brigade, tongue in cheek, because once we get on the rooftop, the whole building's going up. But we're going to
kill. Thought they would blow it up.
He would blow it up. If anyone's going to kill himself in a house-borne improvised explosive device, it's Osama bin Laden. But we accepted that because we got him. I mean, it's better. We're going to die eventually, and we might as well get this guy for everybody else.
Okay, so you climbed up a stairwell.
Yes.
And you come to the third floor.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, you come around the corner, and there standing in front of you is a guy who is skinnier.
Skinnier than I thought and taller. But how I got there was incredible. Because we didn't land where we were supposed to, I was sort of in the back, and I watched my teamwork. And watching other guys, knowing this is their last day on Earth, watching them still do their jobs methodically, slow as smooth as fast, get through this door, get through that door, went up the stairs, cleared some more rooms. And then when we finally got to the top, I was right in the front with one guy in front of me. And he went up the stairs knowing there were suicide bombers. He opened a curtain and jumped on what he thought were suicide bombers. So I watched a guy jump on the grenade that didn't go off. And that's historically heroic. He did that, and I turned the corner just based on it's not like I came through the skylight and saved the day. I just did what every other special operator would have done, and there was bin Laden. And he's taller, 6'3", skinnier, short beard, gray hair. That's his nose. He's a threat. He's not surrendering.
And he's standing behind
his wife. And he's sort of pushing her towards me, and he's a matter of feet away. And
how far?
Three or four feet. Just standing right there, basically in the doorway. And just based on his movement, he's not surrendering. He is a suicide bomber, and I need to treat him like a suicide bomber. That's why I shot him in the head. And I've dealt with suicide bombers before. There's stories in the book. It's so big and loud, and it's over fast that if you don't shoot him in the head, you're going to die with him. And it was over before it started. I shot him.
Did he have a vest? No, he didn't.
Okay. But I thought he did. He wasn't surrendering.
All right. So you shoot him in the head. It's not like in the movies.
No.
They don't go flying back on the bed.
He fell straight down. His head went, as I was looking at the bed, right to the bottom left-hand part of the bed. His wife was there. And I grabbed her to move her aside, gave her a brief search, sat her on the bed. And I remember looking over, and his son was standing there, like a three-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember as a father just thinking, this poor guy has got nothing to do with this. And I picked him up and then moved him. And at that point, other SEALs are coming in the room, and that's when it kind of hit me. And a buddy came up to me and laughed, and he goes, are you all right? And I was like, yeah, what do we do now? And he smiled and said, well, now we find the computers. You've done this hundreds of times. I'm like, yeah, you're right, I'm back. And he goes, yeah, bro, you just killed bin Laden, so your life just changed. It's like, and then we did the rest of our clearance, found what we could electronically.
What happened to his body?
We put it in a body bag, and we carried him out on a helicopter, brought him back and showed him to the admiral. Some of the analysts brought him to another spot. The FBI did the a lot of DNA tests on him and photos and things, and then we handed him off to some Rangers. They flew him out to the Persian Gulf and then disposed of him. And that was it. It was a good call, too. People ask about that, too. And I get all the wild conspiracy theories about he was this and he was that and you didn't kill him. And
I'm telling you, he is in the freezer next to Walt Disney and the Jungle Book cruise right there. That's what's happening. You've started a 501c3. You started a mission. It's your charity is yourgratefulnation.org. What is it?
I got out of the Navy at about 17 years, which is 3 years shy of a pension. And I realized that how difficult you think it is to find a job because all you know is what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But you have skills, especially as a veteran, but especially as a special operator that employers want, which is stress management, team building, show up on time, loyalty, things like that, and they'll hire. And I talked to a lot of guys that want to get out, but they'd rather go to combat than fill out a resume because at least combat makes sense. So what we do with Your Grateful Nation is we find out what line of work they want. It's individualized. Find out what they want, where they want to live. We'll find that company, get them a mentor, put them through a nine-month program, and then they get placed in their second career. And it's the best email I get every other day is, you know, we placed Staff Sergeant Jones with this job with Fox Sports, or we did this, and this guy's working at Merrill Lynch. And having the families, the wives at some of the events that we have, they'll just say, we couldn't have done this. Our family could not have done this without Your Grateful Nation. It's the best feeling. It's my passion right
now. I'll tell you, the servicemen that I know, and every, you know, everybody has a, well, not a Bo Bergdahl, but every, you know, profession has dirtbags in it. But there is a higher percentage of honor and integrity, I think, in the armed forces than any other.
No doubt about it. And the one thing you can't teach in college that they said the military guys have is loyalty. They're so loyal. And honestly, Your Grateful Nation started as let's help the vets get jobs. Now it's, do you want to make your company better? We'll give you someone that you...
Are we still, is the Navy that you went into in 96, is it still the Navy that it, I mean, a lot of parents that listen to this program are very concerned, especially over the last 8 years, but they wonder what the rot has been. We've taken out just war theory. We've changed fundamentally.
A lot of the social experimentation's affected it quite a bit. A lot of the verbiage, you can't, like they said, my favorite word, and I even use it in the book, is shipmate. I love the word shipmate. They took it out of boot camp because it's derogatory. You can't call people shipmate. I love that word.
Can't you call a shipmate?
I don't know. I think they changed it to sea warrior.
Oh my gosh, I said sea warrior.
I mean, that's again hiding from the big elephant and dungarees in the room. Oh, it's like, come on, gosh. He's there. And I mean, as far as the other stuff, I mean, there are places you don't need the military to test social experiments. I mean, should there be women in combat? Well, we've had women in combat. Should there be gays in the military? We have had gays in the military. Nobody cared. But the media wanted to make a big thing out of it, a big political thing. It's like, yeah, they're here. They're doing fine. Why do we need to... Morale is so big in the military, in units in combat. You need to have morale high to succeed. And when you start putting nonsensical baggage on them, it wears on the morale. There's no reason for it. And then
who was it we had in last couple of weeks that was talking about the, you know, all of the restrictions put on our military that, you know, it's...
Rules of engagement.
Rules of engagement are just insane.
Yeah, that's a tough one. People shouldn't be wondering if they're going to go to jail for taking this shot when it's, you know... Either I had a thought, though, since we're experimenting, the person who's in an office typing up the rules of engagement, you should have someone shooting at them while they're typing. That'll work. How are you going to defend yourself? You can sit there and type or you can do something about it.
The Operator is the name of the book, Firing the Shots That Killed Osama Bin Laden and My Years as a SEAL Team Warrior. Robert O'Neill writes it in a way that you are there standing behind and seeing everything and feeling everything that he felt. The Operator is the name of the book, and his charity, if you want to get involved, is yourgratefulnation.org, yourgratefulnation.org. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's awesome to be here.
You bet.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
You know what's amazing is... You know, the military used to be perceived and mocked as a bunch of Gomer Piles. And if you're my age, you know what that means. You even know what that means, Stu?
Gomer was not intelligent,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he was like, well, golly.
Was that a TV show?
Thank you, Jeffy. But it is not. I mean, every single person I know. I talk to these guys who are like, yeah, I was in SEALs, blah, blah, blah. I'm a doctor now. Me too. And I did my thing and then I went and became a physician. Crazy.
It's that bizarre thing too. I know it's completely being selfish and self-centered. I fully admit this going into this statement. But as I was sitting there listening to him, I'm thinking to myself, the best thing I've ever accomplished, like, doesn't even make page 10 of his resume. I've done nothing in my life. Gosh. Well, this stupid thing, all these years of spending doing a dumb show with you, and this guy's out here killing Osama bin Laden.
What's incredible, 400 missions,
I know.
Two silver stars, four bronze with valor. Four bronze with valor. A Joint Service Commendation Medal with valor. Three Presidential Unit Citations. Navy Marine Corps Commendation Medal with valor.
And it took him less than 20 years to do it.
I know.
Loser.
Yeah, and now he's just starting on, thought I'd turn the page. I'm going to invent the flying car.
Yeah.
I mean, jeez.
Yeah. Off the air, I said to him, back in the 2012 election, a lot of people, and with no ill intent, shorthanded Obama's achievements as, and he killed bin Laden. And I kept thinking to myself at that time, what about the guy who actually did it? Isn't that annoying to him to keep hearing everyone saying, well, Obama killed bin Laden? I asked him that, and he was like, I was just the guy who turned the corner, was his answer. I'm just glad we got him. I was just the guy who turned the corner. That is, it's a different way of thinking. That's why, you love having these guys involved. That's why I think all of the military appointments from Donald Trump were the ones that were the most well-received.
It's the only institution we still trust.
Yeah.
And they're doing everything they can to destroy that.
Yes, they are.
But it's the only thing left that you trust.
They're not going to destroy it with guys like that on board, though. No way.
No, unless they can turn them. And that's a slow process. That's not turning this generation. It's turning the next generation. And that's, that's frightening. If, the one thing that really we are, the reason why we cry when our military goes by, at least, some of the country does.
Right.
Reason is because of the honor behind it. It's the honor that's behind it. That's what moves, a lot of people in the left, they don't understand the 4th of July the way others do. They don't understand, saluting the flag and what it means and the Star Spangled Banner. They just don't relate to it. And they see people who cry over that as ridiculous. But we're not crying over the flag. We're not crying over all the great accomplishments of, GM in the day and Ford and America and wheat and the fruited plain. At least me, I get teary-eyed because of the honor behind it. The idea that we can be better than we are today. That is a touching thought. And he described it quite well as going in to kill Obama, going in to kill an Osama bin Laden, and he did it for that woman who held her dignity holding her dress all the way down from windows on the world to her death below the World Trade Center. That's incredible. Incredible. Back in just a second. Is there another way out? Yes.
Glenn Beck.
Mercury.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. Welcome to the program. There is a lot going on. James Comey sent a farewell letter to the FBI after being fired by Trump. It's exactly what you expect from James Comey. I don't agree with James Comey on some of his policies. They're really quite frightening, some of them. But listen to this. I have long believed that a president can fire an FBI director for any reason or for no reason at all.
I'm not going to spend time on the decision or the way it was executed. I hope you won't either. It's done. I'll be fine. And although I'll miss you and the mission deeply. I said to you before that in times of turbulence, the American people should see the FBI as a rock of competence, honesty, and independence. What makes leaving the FBI hard is the nature and quality of its people, who together make it that rock for America. It's hard to leave a group of people who are committed to doing the right thing. I hope that it is that you will continue to live our values and the mission of protecting the American people and upholding the Constitution. If you do that, you too will be sad when you leave, and the American people will be safer. Working with you has been one of the greatest joys of my life. Thank you for that gift. That is the way an honorable man leaves. However, upholding the Constitution wasn't always interpreted the same way. We're in trouble in America because I believe we have the same policies being passed back and forth. And as you've seen with even Colbert this week, you need an instruction manual. You need an alert on your phone. Oh, this policy that we were just against, you need to cheer for it now because we've just passed it. It's crazy what's going on. Is there another way? The answer, yes. We explain it right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
We've invited the chairman of the Libertarian Party on, Nicholas Sarwark. He's 37 years old. He took over the head of the Libertarian Party when he was 34. He's a former public defender and wants to grow the Libertarian Party. Welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm fabulous. Thanks so much for having me on, Glenn.
You bet. When you look back at 2016. Do you see that as a missed opportunity for the Libertarian Party?
Absolutely not. We took advantage of the opportunities that we were given. We had been doing work, as you probably know, the Libertarian Party has been around for 45 years now, and it's been small and it's been growing slowly and steadily over time. 2016 was a huge opportunity. The old parties decided they wanted to nominate the worst people they could find,
right.
And they did.
Right.
We nominated two very experienced former governors who were very popular Republican governors in Democratic states. So we had kind of the perfect storm.
But were they, and I hate this test because no one ever passes the libertarian test. You can talk to any libertarian and they will convince you that you're not libertarian enough. So it doesn't, so I hate this test. But these guys were for a lot of big government policies when they were government and when they were in government, and they also, didn't meet basic fundamental principles of freedom of religion, et cetera, et cetera. And we felt, at least, and you know, I don't know who the Libertarian Party is trying to appeal to, but we felt at least. And still do. We belong in the Libertarian Party because we're strict constitutionalists.
Right.
But we don't feel welcome there. And we certainly didn't feel welcome with Gary Johnson.
Really? And who made you feel unwelcome, Glenn?
You.
Gary
it
Johnson.
It was you. It was you.
That's usually me.
No, it was Gary Johnson.
Really?
Yeah. He was on our show a couple of times.
Uh-huh. And we had a good conversation with him.
Okay.
But like, for example, a quick example to back this up. He mentioned a lot to a lot of different media sources,
right,
the percentage of issues he agreed with Bernie Sanders on. That was
okay.
A big talking point for him. And I think to a lot of people in this audience, even though I can't imagine the percentage he was quoting, which was like 80% or something like that, was actually
right.
True, because he was using that as such a kind of a outward talking point to many media sources and mentioned it even here on the show.
Right.
I think that scared a lot of the audience away.
Also, he made a point every time he came on this program to mention that he distrusted religion more than he distrusted the United States, the government. And we were floored by that. Now, I have a healthy distrust of religion as well. Religion gets us into problems just like government does.
Right.
It depends on who's running those things. Yeah. So we just felt like we and this is why I wanted to have you on.
Yeah.
Like Austin Peterson, we loved. Loved. Where are you guys headed? Because I know America, especially the youth, is headed towards this, you know, this idea of a new kind of Marxism and big government. Are you guys constitutionalists or a hybrid of things? What is it?
Wow.
It was a long question.
Yeah, that's a huge question. It's a double teaming, which is perfectly fair. I'm used to it. So starting with the Sanders thing.
Yep.
Yeah, Gary Johnson agreed with Bernie Sanders 80% of the things.
May I just say, you're not in a hostile room.
I don't feel like I'm in a hostile room.
All right, good.
I feel like I'm in a friendly room.
Okay,
I'm smiling.
All right.
He agreed with Bernie Sanders on a lot of stuff. I agree with Bernie Sanders on a lot of stuff.
I agree with Bernie Sanders on the problems, not necessarily the solutions.
I agree with a lot of conservatives on a lot of stuff. Libertarianism is something fundamentally different. And there are a lot of conservatives who feel not welcome, as you feel. That's a normal feeling. There are a lot of liberals who feel not welcome.
Right.
And the reason is the same. We kind of deny the validity of the paradigm of left and right.
So
left and right is not important. What is important is freedom and government control. So if you're pro-freedom on an issue, you're for empowering individuals over empowering government, we're with you. Whether the issue that we're with you on is from the left or from the right. And the thing that makes people feel uncomfortable is if you've been in this left-right paradigm, hearing somebody say nice things about a freedom issue that's on the left makes your skin kind of crawl. And if you talk to liberals, it's the same thing. If I say something nice about what a conservative did because it was pro-freedom on that issue, but it's from the right, they're like, well, you guys are just bad Republicans.
I would agree with you in most cases with this audience, not all of this audience, but a large share of this audience. Here's the problem with Gary Johnson. Gary Johnson came in and he said twice, and then the running mate, Weld, said the same thing, that we said, how can you have a law, you know, that a photographer has to take a picture or wedding cake? It doesn't make any sense. You can't be for ultimate freedom and maximum personal responsibility and also say, oh, and the government should regulate that. As Penn Jillette and I talked about,
right.
You know, you should be able to have your business do anything that you want. And I have a reason to go, I'm never going to go there.
I love Penn Jillette. So this is going to be hard for him to watch or listen to. That's right to a point. There's I can get in a long discussion of Anglo-American contract law and stuff like that, but that's probably really boring for your listeners. The point is that there's this tradition of something being open to the public. A movie theater is open to the public. A drugstore is open to the public. And open to the public means if you're a person who's not belligerent and you come in, I sell you the stuff off of my shelves. I don't get to say, hey, you can't buy the candy bar because you're white. Sorry, leave. That runs through our legal history. There's also a long tradition in America, which is really different, of a strong and vibrant First Amendment, both the Free Exercise Clause and the Free Speech Clauses, that say, I get to say whatever I want. The government can't stop me. Other people can disagree. And I get to exercise my religion as I choose, as long as I don't violate laws of general applicability. And there can be no compelled speech. And that's big. You can't make me say something I don't want to say as the government. The tension comes when you get in the middle. Because what are we talking about when we talk about cakes? Because it's a cake issue, and it's a hypothetical, and it's weird, but up in the Northwest, it's not hypothetical. Are we talking about, hey, it's a Costco sheet cake, I just want to buy a cake? In which case, yeah, you have to sell that cake to everybody.
It's off the shelf.
If it's, I want you to write, I want you to express, I want you to put words onto the cake, then it's different. And then photography gets into a weird spot because, you know,
some
of it's art, some of it's documentary, you know, like art is the artist's message in there. These are hard issues. There isn't one right answer. It's not black and white. A lot of life isn't black and white. And what I've been trying to do is get libertarians to focus on how many areas do we agree in?
Yeah.
How many areas do we agree in? If
a
this
lot.
Is a point of contention where you are a little farther on the free speech side than the Costco sheet cake side, that's okay because we agree on so much else. So
I agree, let's have a beer and talk about this, but
let's work together on all the other stuff.
I agree with you. It just, to me, it seems like a very easy call. For instance, you don't have a right to come in and to me to come in and say, oh, well, I'm just not serving your kind, so you get out. Mm-hmm. I got to serve you everything. But if you're asking me to do something that is part of a religious ceremony or something that I feel is religious, then that's an easy call.
It's coerced expression.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just so easy, black and white.
That did not seem to be Gary's position with what you're articulating I'm totally comfortable. In fact, I agree with you on what you just articulated. That's not what he articulated.
I got that. Yeah. And no candidate is perfect.
Yeah.
No
person
is perfect. I love Gary Johnson. Mm-hmm. He's strong in some areas. He's weak in others.
Austin Peterson is
strong in some areas.
And weak in others.
Weak in others.
So,
and the delegates make those choices.
Right.
You know, you want to talk about big differences between the Libertarian Party and the old parties. We had a convention in Orlando where 1,000 delegates from across the country, selected by state Libertarian parties, came into a room. Our bylaws explicitly prohibit bound delegates. Every single one of those people was totally free to vote for any presidential nominee. They got to meet them, they got to shake their hands, they got to see them in debates. And those delegates in that room made a choice about who they thought would best represent the Libertarian Party. My job as chairman is to empower the choice of those delegates. So I would get these calls where people would say, well, what are you gonna do about Weld or what are you gonna do about Johnson? The delegates decide,
and
I don't decide.
No, I know that. No, I agree with you. It's not you. It's not the party. Now, the question is, because to me, this looks like such an easy place to go and unite the country, because I really believe I can live next to Ben and Jerry for the rest of my life, and they can be...
They live here?
No.
I thought they were up in Vermont.
Yeah. But I could live next to them for the rest of my life, and we'd be perfectly fine neighbors.
Right.
It's only when I try to affect them or their business or what they believe, or they try to do it to me, coercively through governments. So, and I think that's where a vast majority of America is. I could be wrong. How do you shape that message to cut through and appeal to more people? Because I think that's where people are.
I think you start by changing people's premises. The veterans of the culture wars, like many veterans, bear scars from that. Because these are fights that we had during the 90s and the 2000s. Between the right and the left over who gets to have government tell you how to live your life. Mm-hmm. That's what made them so bitter.
Right.
That's what made them so angry, because the stakes of losing were so high.
Correct.
In a libertarian society, what we change, what the party is trying to do in changing America, is take that option off the table. No matter how much we disagree about how you live your life or I live my life, which we may, probably have some disagreements. We agree as a premise that I won't try and use the government to control you, and you won't use it to try and control me.
This is so easy.
And it makes for better debates and discussions and dialogues, because we can get heated and we can get angry and we can shout and yell or cry or whatever, but we know at the end of the day it's safe because we're exchanging ideas, not fists or guns. That's what we're trying to change about the culture of politics in this country. Libertarian politics is basically, it's anti-politics. Politics, political economy generally, is different groups of people arguing over which one of them gets to take your tax money and give it to their corporate cronies.
Yep.
Not theirs, because theirs are the good ones, not the other guys. The other guys, you don't want to give any money to him. But the developer that I know, that's the guy that should get your tax dollars.
We're seeing this with Donald Trump.
The right was against the stimulus package.
Until he did it.
Until he's got a bigger stimulus package and they're for it.
We're fundamentally different because we're the only political party in the country that's dedicated to the idea that you have a right to pursue happiness any way you choose, as long as you don't hurt other people and you don't take their stuff. We're fighting to make it so the government stops taking stuff away from you and stops controlling your life.
Okay, so let's get into that. When we come back, I want to, and you're going to be with me on The Blaze, so we'll maybe spend another 10 minutes, and then tonight at 5 o'clock, we'll spend a full hour. And I really want to concentrate on that because there's a new study out, and this is of conservative millennials. 51% say that the government, that the First Amendment is sacrosanct, that you have a right to speech and right to free press. 49% say that is sacrosanct, but the government has to decide what speech is okay. I mean, it's crazy. And those conservatives that are saying that, how do we change that?
Glenn Beck.
Mercury.
888-727-BECK. The Glenn Beck Program.
We're talking to Nicholas Sarwark. He is the chairman of the Libertarian Party. We have to get to this here in a couple of minutes, and we'll probably spend more time on it tonight. Can you just go over, because I've only got 2 minutes here. Can you just go over and then just tease for tonight to explain this, what you just said to me during the break?
Oh. So you had asked earlier whether or not the Libertarian Party is constitutionalist. Libertarianism is not constitutionalist, but it's not anti-constitutionalist. The Constitution, as written, has good things in it, free speech, Fourth Amendment, stuff like that. And has bad things in it, three-fifths of a person, some anti-democratic stuff. We support freedom, every issue, every time. If the Constitution supports freedom, we're behind the Constitution. If the Constitution takes away freedom, we're against the Constitution. Our North Star is individual liberty, not a particular document written by a particular set of people in a particular place and time. Legally, we're bound by the Constitution.
Yeah, but are you not saying, I mean, goals, is there a better document than the Constitution?
Oh, no. Okay. I mean, it's very much the Churchillian line.
Yeah.
You know, it's the worst system except for all the other ones.
Yeah. Because I'll give you that. I mean, we've had this argument. I had a progressive on the other day, and we were talking about it. And I said, you know, let's just agree on the top 10, the first 10 amendments. And I said, except for the 13th Amendment and Prohibition, the Constitution, all the other amendments are just like, hey, dummy, this is what we were saying in the first 10.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really where we have to get to, because
Bill of Rights is solid. Bill of Rights is solid.
Rock
we're
solid.
Totally behind the Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
And other parts of the Constitution get a little
bit
muddy.
But the Bill of Rights, I think when people talk about the Constitution, I think, you know, they're not talking necessarily about all the inner workings of how the government works and the three-fifths clause, which was in there for a reason that nobody even knows about anymore. But looking at that Bill of Rights, there is a huge connection across all categories.
Absolutely.
All categories. I'm really looking forward to our conversation later today. 5 o'clock on theblaze.com. The Libertarian Party, what is it? What do they believe? And where are they going in 2018 and 2020? You want to be a part of change? Join us tonight, 5 o'clock, only on The Blaze TV, theblaze.com/TV. Join us tonight at 5.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
This is The Glenn Beck Program.
Welcome to the... Welcome to the program. They're grilling the acting FBI director now, McCabe. He says that he believes they have adequate resources for the Russian investigation now. He says that the White House has not interfered to his knowledge at all in that investigation. And remember, this is not a guy who is a Trump guy. He's a guy who, you know, I believe was... Was he Clinton or Obama appointed? He's not a Republican appointed guy.
It's interesting that, you know, because one of the reports was that Comey asked for money a week before, more resources a week before in this investigation that's been denied by the Department of Justice. There are a couple places reporting it. Who knows if it's true? But I don't get the sense, and I could be wrong on this, I don't get the sense that this means Trump has something he's hiding specifically on Russia, or is he's about, like, they were about to get him and then he didn't.
I don't think that at all. I think Trump was like personally motivated against this guy.
He was personally annoyed that he didn't back him enough.
Yeah.
And it looks to, I think, every person outside the White House, at least your initial instinct is, wait a minute, this guy fired the guy who's in the middle of this investigation. Like, wait a minute, what's going on here?
Mm-mm.
And I think that's what the Democrats want you to believe. It may be true. I don't know. But to me, it comes off more as he was annoyed this guy who he, you know, may have thought, because of the letter he sent, you know, a few days before the election, was kind of on his side, wasn't always saying things that were on his side, and it annoyed him. And that kind of, and there is reporting to back that up as well, that was.
But the, only 30 sources. But that's all. Have you ever seen a White House leak like this?
Not that I can remember. And a lot of people are trying to say...
What is your guess? Where does this end, Stu? How does this end?
Wow, I don't know the answer to that. I really don't. I mean, I can't...
If I said to you, we were in impeachment hearings, the Senate was in... Not in a trial, but we are in, like, Watergate-style hearings in August or September. Would that surprise you at all?
In August or September, that's really fast. But it's possible. And let's just take this out, because if you're thinking like, oh, but, you know, Trump's your guy, you're probably annoyed by that. But I think like the better way to look at it, I always look at these things with personal motivations. And what he's done with a lot of these moves, and when he calls people out publicly and he says they're not doing a good job, there are hundreds of people in the FBI that are viscerally loyal to James Comey.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are now motivated to act against the interests of the President of the United States.
So stupid.
And this is through several different parts of the administration and the infrastructure of the federal government. So I'm not saying they're going to make stuff up. I don't think that that's the case. But they're motivated and they are looking to say to themselves, this guy is screwing us. We need to get back at him. Or... just, you know, yeah, what, I'm going to make, I'm not even saying, like, it's not even that.
I don't think that,
that's the
if our FBI
reach,
is,
right?
if our FBI is like that, we're in trouble.
It's not just the FBI.
Right, I know that. But in particular here, the FBI, if they're doing an investigation, they're like, pin it on him. That's bad. But
I think
they would be, I think that you would be more motivated to turn over every single stone.
Partially because you have a personal loyalty to someone who you think is wronged. And partially, I think, because you think to yourself, maybe there is something here where I didn't think there was. You know, you're going to start seeing things through a different prism. And, you know, while Donald Trump may not have done anything wrong at all, people like Michael Flynn did.
Yeah.
They've been fired for it already.
I really don't think that Donald Trump, you know, you want to make him into this big, evil, you know, supervillain. I just don't think he is. You know, go to The Economist today, where he thought he invented priming the pump. He really thinks he came up with that economic theory 2 days ago. So I just don't think he's not that deep of a thinker. It doesn't mean he's not smart and everything else. He's just not that deep of a thinker. So I just don't see him, you know, with some master plan of, you know, coercion or working with the Russians behind the scenes. I think others around him may have been involved in things that weren't the best, and then they got involved back in with his campaign, and they're like, I'm just not going to say anything. I think that happened, but I don't think there's collusion between... I'd be surprised if there was collusion, but we have to know. We have to know.
Right, and look, the bottom line is Republicans are, generally speaking, going to stand behind him if his polls stay in the high 30s. There's a Quinnipiac poll today, I think it was 36% approval rating. That thing starts hitting the 20s, you're going to start seeing a lot of these people who have no spines and don't believe either side of this. They're going to start fleeing from him. And as that goes, it gets much more difficult for him to hold on to what he's holding on to. So I think if the...
Is there a chance, in your opinion, do you believe we could be looking at a President Pence by 2020, not elected President Pence?
I mean, it's funny you say that, because you can put your money where your mouth is on that. And the odds are not crazy. like you, because you can go to these betting sites. PredictWise, I think, has one on this.
For the first time, I think there is a chance that we're looking at an unelected President Pence by 2020.
I think it's possible. I generally think those things are unlikely. But I mean,
But I didn't think it was even possible.
Right. There was a time I actually looked at this.
I didn't say probable. I said possible.
When will Trump leave office? Okay, right now. This is a betting market summary. Mm-hmm. 2020 or later. So it means he fills the first term. It's 51%. Wow. So just over half. They're saying there's a chance, again, these are the betting markets, people putting money on this. 49%
say he's not going to make it through his first term.
He's not going to make it through his first term.
And I think there's a chance that he doesn't even make it to impeachment. I think there's a chance that he gets so surrounded by Indians, and they're like, Don, it ain't going to work well or work out well. And he's like, fine, screw it. And he resigns to go back to do his whatever it is.
At a much happier life.
Yeah, I had a much happier life. I just don't want to do it or whatever. I don't know what he would say.
Right. And just, he finds a way. I did my job. I got all this stuff done. You know, he comes up with some justification and says, bye. It's not impossible. Again, there's no reason, like, we're not there now, obviously. It's an interesting thing that people are talking about it so openly.
And here's the problem with this. We can't have a rational conversation about this. You can't have a rational conversation with either side. Because one side is into full defense, and because they know the other side is in full attack. And so you can't have a reasonable conversation. For instance, the way Betsy DeVos has been treated at this graduation commencement ceremony, did you see this? Oh my gosh. She starts speaking, and as soon as she starts to speak, students jumped up out of their chairs, started to boo her, some turning their backs to her. School president said, your degrees, you don't sit down now, be quiet. Your degrees are going to be mailed to you. This all comes, they're black universities, and this comes from her comments that she said, black colleges were established as a reaction, to racial discrimination, not an exercise in school choice. She said, which she later recanted, the founders of historically black colleges and universities were the real pioneers of school choice. Well, yes and no. No, you couldn't go in. If you read the story of Booker T. Washington, and you know the Tuskegee Institute, yes, it's because he couldn't get into a white college, but others did. I mean, they got into, you know, Harvard and other places. He didn't. He couldn't afford it, et cetera, et cetera. So he went in and he started. But after he started it, after it was going, it wasn't only because of you couldn't get into other places. It was also because this is important for us as people. We have a different background. Remember, he's teaching at the time former slaves. He's a former slave. So it's twofold. At the beginning, yes, because most times you couldn't get in. In the South, definitely not. But most times you couldn't get in. So you did have to have a school choice. I mean, you know, you could say, you know, we're one of the pioneers of homeschooling because I try to get my kids into private schools that I want to. And because they're Mormon, there's, the good Christian schools that are here won't let them in. Well, okay. Am I a pioneer? No, that's not the whole story behind it. The problem with society right now, I'm not suing anybody. It's there. It's a private school. They can run it any way they want.
Do you have the audio of this? We have the booing and heckling.
Yeah,
the commencement speech.
Go ahead.
This is here it is.
Betsy DeVos serves as the 11th U.S. Secretary of Education and was confirmed by the U.S. Senate on February 7, 2017, after being nominated by President Donald J. Trump. And she has been involved in education policy.
And the audio is so bad, it's hard to really hear, but they're booing her, obviously.
Thank you so very, very much for this. Great honor and privilege.
All right, I think that's enough for the audio. But, I mean, that's obviously pretty bad.
Yeah. But now, and here's the thing. This goes back to what we were talking to, you know, with the head of the Libertarian Party. There's no such place as a free speech zone. There's no such place as a safe zone, especially in colleges and universities. I mean, we are turning our backs to people. You know, if Mahmoud Ahmadinejad comes and he's speaking, I want to listen, but I also want to protest outside. I want to protest outside. But I'm going to let the man speak, but I'm also going to come up with, you know, cogent arguments on why he's wrong. That's the way this works. This idea of shutting people up is so unbelievably un-American. You don't shut people. We never tried to shut anyone up on the left. I begged you to read their books. I begged you to go watch their speeches. You got to know what they believe. They're the ones who try to shut everybody up.
Now, usually there are safe spaces for Democrats on MSNBC. That's kind of very typical of us. It's in a very safe space. But this is another example of trying to get people to actually talk. Maxine Waters was on there, and she was trying to explain her varying points of view on the Comey situation. Listen to this.
You obviously have been very critical of James Comey in the past. You said that he had no credibility. I assume that you support the president's decision then to fire his FBI director.
No, I do not necessarily support the president's decision. If the president had not gone all over the country praising him about the way he handled Hillary and the emails, if the president said he had confidence in him, if the president had not said he was a part of his team.
But Congresswoman, yes. I understand that in the past he was praising him, but if you said that FBI Director James Comey had no credibility, wouldn't you support the fact that the president, then candidate Trump, now President Trump made the decision to get rid of him?
This is MSNBC.
No, not necessarily. And let me tell you
why.
You have an investigation going on where the president is implicated. And this is a serious investigation. I've been trying to get people to focus on this connection with the Kremlin and with Putin. I have a resolution that I introduced in February. I think there's enough there that we know about the Kremlin and about Putin to be concerned about whether or not there was collusion.
So to be clear, you think...
And I believe that they should have to connect the dots and get the facts, because I think it will lead to the impeachment of this president.
So, Congresswoman, respecting that, to be clear, you believe it would have been better to keep in place an FBI director who you said had no credibility to oversee this investigation than to find someone who you think would be a better choice?
No, but I believe the president thought that. Don't forget, you're talking about what some Democrats said, what I said, but don't forget, he was the president. The president supported him. He had confidence in him. It was within his power. And
but you said he had no credibility, so it would seem to make sense that he should get rid of him.
Who is this reporter on MSNBC?
Under investigation, this president basically has interfered with an investigation where he may be implicated. That's outrageous, and that's why we haven't...
So the new guy is not a Trump guy. The new guy is not a Trump guy. So the investigation is going forward. What doesn't make sense here is that is what this reporter, shockingly on MSNBC, is pointing out. You said he had no credibility. So if he comes out and says there's no connection, you're not going to believe it anyway. And you will get everyone involved on your side to say there's no credibility. So replace him with somebody that has credibility that you can oversee and make sure that it's done right. But what will happen is this guy is not the guy's replacing Comey is not a Trump guy.
He's not the official replacement yet.
Right. Well, he's acting.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, you look at this, and if it goes on, no matter who he appoints, they will always point back to this. If they say Trump didn't do anything, they will always point back to this moment. Well, that's because, you know, he fired the guy who really had the goods on him.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Program. Mercury.